Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Anything for You by Marissa Finch, narrated by Lauren Ezzo. Chapter 1. When the call came, I was asleep, but not asleep. When you become a parent, if you choose to become one someday, you'll know what that means. Asleep, but not asleep. It's the way I slept when you were out of the house. When your curfew wasn't for another half hour, and I had no real reason to worry. Because, after all, I raised you to be a responsible young woman, everybody said so. But I still couldn't relax until you were home safe. In the bed, down the hall from me. Where you belonged. So, asleep, but not asleep. The digital trill from my phone roused me, slowly, and then all at once. I sat up in my bed before I was even aware of waking, fumbling on my nightstand for the device. I already knew it was you. I had programmed a special ringtone for you. The prelude to Bach's Cello Suite No. 1. One of my favorite pieces to hear you play, even though you didn't personally care for it. Too predictable, you'd dismissed it. But I loved its sweeping grandeur. I pressed the phone to my ear in the dark. Ella, I said, instead of hello. Mom? Your voice on the other end of the line sounded distant, and even though it was only a single syllable, I heard what was underneath it. Fear. What is it, baby? My heart thundered in my chest under the worn, soft Oakwood Academy t-shirt I'd been asleep but not asleep in. My fingers caged around the phone, practically in rigor. Something happened. You let out a shuddering breath that wasn't quite a sob, but almost. What is it? I asked again. What happened? For a second, you didn't answer. My brain played through a juddering reel of every terrible scenario it could come up with. You, in a car accident. Hurt. Arrested. You, kidnapped. Raped. Locked in a dungeon somewhere. You. Dead. I tried to tell myself that since you were the one calling, that at least ruled out some of the more grisly options, but the thought didn't make me feel any better. Well, barely. It was a logical thought, and logic couldn't get a toehold in the wall of panic that barricaded my mind. Something that, again, you might never understand until you have kids of your own. I think you should come, you said, finally. Just come. I'm coming. I'm already on my way, I said, without even realizing it was true. I'd climbed out of bed, had yanked on the flannel pajama pants I'd shucked off earlier. I stuffed my bare feet into a pair of moccasin-style slippers and grabbed my favorite long cardigan off the back of the bedroom door. Where are you?
I'm at Wingrove Park.
North entrance or south?
North.
You swallowed. I could hear it over the phone.
I'm in the playground.
I almost laughed. Picking you up at a playground seemed innocuous, especially after my visions of hospitals and police stations and dank and terrifying basements. But then you said,
Mom, please hurry. I think it's bad.
My heart resumed its position at the very back of my throat. I'll be there as soon as I can. I'm leaving right now. I hung up the phone. I hadn't bothered turning on any lights, but it was easy to make my way through the single-story house in the dark. Past the bathroom with the blue tub and toilet I'd vowed for the past 8 years to replace and had never gotten around to. Past your bedroom, with your door wide open, your bed still made. Past the living room, with your cello looming in the corner of my eye like a human figure. In the kitchen, I grabbed my car keys from the little ceramic frog bowl you'd made for me when you were in third grade, a lifetime ago. I raced to our car, a 10-year-old Ford Edge in bright red, a color I never would have chosen for myself, but I got it used and the price was too good to pass up. The Straub, You called it, as in the strawberry. A name that had stuck. I started up the car. The taillights flashed obscenely bright in the dark driveway. It was almost midnight, which meant our entire cul-de-sac had retired for the evening. Only a couple of houses still had porch lights on, and though there were streetlights, they were spaced too far apart to properly illuminate the whole street. Instead, they lit their own individual pockets like a dozen theatrical spotlights, waiting for a star. Our bungalow was exactly halfway between two streetlights, which meant it was always dark. Except now, of course, with my taillights glowing a lurid red. I backed the car up carefully, commanding myself not to do anything stupid. The last thing I needed was to get into an accident or to get stopped for speeding. I eased out into the street, swiveling my head both ways out of habit, even though no one was around. I caught a movement out of the corner of my eye. Across the street. The bay window. There. A curtain. I grimaced. Of course Arthur would be awake. Of all the residents on the street, Art Poole was the only one I disliked. I never told you that, I don't think. I tried to be polite to him, especially when you were around, because it was important to me that you learn to treat people with respect. But there was always something about old Art that put me off. I don't know how to say it any better than that. I know you felt it too, despite my best efforts. I'd noticed you going out of your way to cross the street when you saw him coming. I lifted one hand in greeting. I couldn't tell if Art saw me or not, but the curtain fluttered back into place. I kept going. My resolution not to do anything stupid lasted all of 2 minutes. I went easy on the gas until I reached the end of the cul-de-sac, then I floored it all the way to Wingrove. The park wasn't far, and less than 10 minutes later, I pulled the Straub into the parking lot near the north entrance. Mine was the only car there. Wingrove Park, like the rest of the town of Silver Mills, was deserted at midnight. I bounded from the car and through the park's tall iron gate, which swung open with an obnoxious squawk. Like many things in Silver Mills, the gate and adjoining fence were purely for show. The fence wrapped only the portion of the park accessible from the street, which was the north, south, and east sides. The western edge of the park butted up against a deep forest, acres of deciduous trees with trunks so thick you couldn't wrap your arms all the way around them. The park's proximity to such untamed space had driven me crazy when you were small. How many times did I imagine you wandering off into those woods alone, your tiny toddler legs taking you forever far away from me? The woods were to my right as I hurried toward the playground, and at that moment they felt particularly dark and ominous. Though the paved path was lit by LED lights, designed, of course, to resemble old-fashioned lamp posts, because that's the kind of place Silver Mills was and the kind of thing Silver Mills liked, the gloom of the forest encroached on me anyway, swallowing the white light, edging it out. I whipped out my phone and texted you. I'm here. Where are you? I wanted to call, but I wasn't sure of the circumstances I'd be walking into. Would you be free to talk? Were there other people with you? Your reply came almost immediately. Still in playground. Okay, two men. I walked as fast as my legs would carry me, and when that wasn't fast enough, I broke into a run. I had spent the entire drive trying to rationalize this whole thing, trying to convince myself that it was nothing. Maybe you were drunk or high, or maybe one of your friends was. Maybe you panicked. I'd always told you that you could call me any time you got into trouble, that I'd always be willing to come pick you up, no questions asked. I'd almost succeeded in convincing myself that's all this was. A minor incident we'd never even think about again. But with the dark woods pressing in on me, those wispy, hopeful thoughts dissipated. Like they were mist. Like they were nothing at all. With each step, that forced optimism felt closer to impossible, and dread encroached on me as sure as the darkness. By the time I spotted the swing set that sat at the northernmost part of the playground, my anxiety had returned in full. I focused on putting one foot in front of the other, ignoring the trees that loomed to my left, the dark cloud cover, low enough to touch. I wanted to call out for you, but something told me not to. And in the end, I didn't need to. I spotted you as soon as I passed through the red plastic fencing that cordoned off the sand-filled playground from the rest of the park. You were leaning against the main play structure, staring at your phone. I could see your lovely face illuminated in the glow from the screen. I breathed a sigh of relief. You were fine. You looked fine anyway. A smudge of dirt or something else across your cheek, but otherwise fine. Then I saw the other girl. I almost stopped. Almost. I slowed my pace. I tried to process the scene in front of me. I wasn't watching you anymore, but the other girl. Later, I wondered how I knew it was a girl from that distance and at that angle. I couldn't really see anything but the top of a blonde head and a long swath of pale denim sprawled in the dirt a few feet from where you stood. But I did. I knew it was a girl. Just like I knew the girl was dead. Chapter 2. I stopped walking when I was about 6 feet away. The body lay sprawled on the ground in front of me. You were standing off to the side, still staring down at your phone. You hadn't noticed me yet. What the hell happened? My voice cut sharply through the dark. It sounded like the pealing squawk of a microphone. You, startled, dropped your phone. You bent to pick it up, stuffing it into your pocket before you rushed me.
Mommy!
You hurled yourself into my arms. I wrapped them automatically around you, pulling you against my chest, resting my cheek against the crown of your head. You hadn't called me Mommy in years, and I don't mind telling you, part of me liked it. Maybe that was the first sign things were not going to go well from here on out. That sense of satisfaction I got from holding you in my arms, from hearing the naked need in your voice, was like the first taste of a designer drug. I couldn't take my eyes off the body on the ground in front of me. I knew for sure by then that it was a girl, because I recognized the pale face, upturned toward the starless sky. Amber Albright. She'd once been just a girl I'd occasionally pass in the halls at Oakwood, on my way to my office or waiting for you to finish up in rehearsal. But for the last year, I'd been happy to see her turn into a close friend of yours. Your best friend, maybe, though cello had always kept you too busy for those sorts of things. I knew Amber as a sweet girl. That was my thought then, though my opinion of her would change several times before all was said and done. I knew her as a girl who was always singing, whose cheeks were always flushed and pink, who wore so much scented body spray that the distinct smell of peaches followed her everywhere, lingering in the hallways long after she'd made it to her next class. Here in Windgrove Park, her cheeks were no longer pink, but when I breathed in, I swore I could smell peaches. I swallowed. All I could think about in that moment was how cold she looked, even though the May air was unseasonably warm. You trembled against my chest, and I realized you were crying. Sobbing, really. You hadn't cried in front of me in years. That maternal drug proliferated through my system. I pulled you closer, rubbed your back like I did when you were small. Because, God, did you cry back then. Scream, really. And the only thing that could make you stop was to be in my arms. I spent hours bouncing you all over that tiny, dank apartment, hushing you and smothering you with kisses and being needed by you. My embrace had the same calming effect on you now. Slowly, and with a couple of giant, gulping breaths, you pulled away, wiped your eyes against the sleeve of your denim jacket. "What happened?" I asked again. My voice was completely level, which surprised me, because inside I felt like a bottle of shook-up soda. You sniffled.
"It was an accident."
Your voice had that shaky, stuttering quality that meant you were about to start crying again. "Can you tell me how it happened?" Nice and even.
"We were just fooling around. Chasing each other, it was stupid, and then she just..."
You trailed off, gazing up at the play structure. In the dark, it looked imposing, all sharp angles and way too tall. "She fell?" I asked, filling in a blank space I didn't need to. You nodded. I crouched down beside Amber. The idea of touching her scared me for some reason, but I forced myself to put my fingers against her throat. Something I should have done as soon as I got here. I'd been so focused on you, on making sure you were okay. But what if Amber wasn't dead, but only hurt, knocked out? What if she needed an ambulance and it was my delay that... But I couldn't feel anything under my fingertips. I moved them all over in case they were in the wrong spot, hoping desperately to feel something. Anything at all. I leaned over and pressed my cheek against Amber's lips, tried to feel if she was breathing. I prayed for even the tiniest puff of air. I smelled peaches, sickly sweet, but felt nothing. The adrenaline that had been coursing through my veins spiked again, as if I'd been poked with an electric cattle prod. I stayed leaned over Amber, trying to remember my CPR training. I'd first taken it when you were young as a way of banishing the visions that used to haunt me. You vaulting headfirst off a swing set. You lying face down in the bathtub. You blue and choking on a grape. Now that I worked at Oakwood, I was required to maintain the certification. But what seemed so straightforward in those weekend workshops felt completely different there in Windgrove Park, with fear and darkness pressing against me, and you buzzing anxiously in the background. I took a couple of deep breaths and steadied myself, then began. I tilted Amber's chin, covered her mouth with mine. It came back to me quickly, the rhythm of it. 1, 2, 3, 4. I did it for a long time, forcing my own breath into Amber's lungs. I lost track of you and of the woods beside us and of the moon overhead. I didn't notice the lightheadedness that came over me until your hand touched my shoulder. I sat back on my heels.
"Mom, it's not working."
I looked over. Your long, delicate fingers rested on my sweater. The same fingers that had won you both prizes and praise over the years. The fingers that got you into Juilliard. I squeezed your hand. Gently, of course.
"I know, baby. She's dead, isn't she?"
"Yeah." You gripped my shoulder tighter.
"I killed her."
Your voice was whisper soft, but it blazed in my ear like a gunshot. I stood and spun around to face you.
"What? Baby, no, it was an accident." "But it was my fault. I was chasing her and she slipped and... She didn't even want to go up there. She wanted to go on the swings. She loves the swings. And if we hadn't..."
You were crying again and I enveloped you in my arms. My heart broke for you.
"It's not your fault. I promise you, it was an accident. A horrible, terrible accident."
I remembered another accident. Another dead girl. A part of my past I never liked to dredge up. I shuddered and pushed the thoughts away. Over your head, I looked at the play structure and tried to envision the scene. You lunging for Amber, laughing. Amber jumping back out of reach, laughing too, her cheeks flushed. I pictured her losing her footing, toppling over backward. There were wooden beams at the top of the structure meant to prevent that exact sort of thing, but they were intended for much younger and smaller children. On an adult or even a teenaged girl, they'd hit just above the knee, maybe mid-thigh. Not hard to see how Amber could have tumbled right over if she lost her balance. And while the structure wasn't very high, all it took was one wrong angle to... well, to do this. As if you could read my mind, you pulled away. I guess we should call 911, right? I didn't answer. Mom? We need to call 911, right? Right? Your voice rose. Quiet, baby, I'm thinking. What I was thinking about, my darling daughter, was you. I knew this was an accident, but what if no one else saw it that way? I wasn't an expert on the law, but I was pretty sure accidental homicide was a thing. Manslaughter, maybe. Once the police got involved, there was no telling what might happen. You were 18, old enough to be treated as an adult if it came to that. I thought of something else. Were you guys drinking tonight? I won't be mad, just tell me the truth. It's important. You looked down at the ground. Your head bobbed slightly in affirmation. My stomach turned. Who got the alcohol? You didn't want to answer me at first. I shot you a look. A mom look, as you would have joked under better circumstances. Ella, this is important. I did. You mumbled. You wouldn't meet my eyes. I bit at my bottom lip. Another factor to take into consideration. That's all. A factor. Something to consider. I didn't want to admit, even to myself, exactly what it was I was considering. Instead, I let myself think about your Juilliard audition. March, it had been. We'd flown out to New York together. It was the first time either of us had ever been, even though Maine wasn't so terribly far away. You had always wanted to go. Not just to Juilliard, but to the city itself. It had been all you could talk about since last summer, and your fervor had only increased after you made the school shortlist and were invited to audition. I wasn't really as enthusiastic about the trip. There were a lot of things I didn't love about living in a small town, but I'd still pick Silver Mills over a sprawling landfill like New York any day. But I'd pick you over both of them. So I pushed aside my own feelings, and we went. On that trip, I saw the city through your eyes. I saw the legions of skyscrapers not as imposing guardians, but as empires of possibility. I saw the endless concrete blocks not as labyrinthine, but as a playground. I watched you live and breathe that city for 3 whole days, and I started to get it. Then came the Juilliard audition. Everything I thought I knew about you was demolished that day. Demolished and rebuilt into your very own empire of possibility. Because although I'd heard you play before, thousands of times probably, it had never been like that. I realized in that moment that you were magnificent. Not magnificent in the way that all parents view their progeny, but truly magnificent. You were born to play the cello. Walking into your audition room, you looked ethereal and painfully alive at the same time. I stayed out in the hallway listening, and I wept through your entire performance, from Bach's Cello Suite No. 5 to Shostakovich's Concerto No. 1. I imagined your hands, your fingers, gliding effortlessly over the cello's long and elegant neck. I pictured your face the way your eyes would have fluttered closed. Not in concentration, but in transcendence. Magnificent. The evaluators agreed. You were offered admittance to the school. No wait list. I could still remember the day you'd gotten the email, the way you had shrieked and wrapped your arms around my neck. the way I had cried like a baby, again, embarrassing you to death even though there was no one around to see us. I couldn't stop. I felt elation and relief for you, but there was something more complicated in there, too. Sorrow, if you can believe it. Because I was losing you. Soon you would belong to New York, and then to the world. But under all that, there was something even more profound. A quiet murmur of humility. Of the knowledge that my daughter had a gift, and that nothing would, or even could, stop it from being made manifest. That's what I felt in that moment, as I looked down at poor Amber Albright. I thought not of the girl whose life had been snuffed out, but of you, my own daughter, whose magnificent life was only just beginning. Maybe it's another one of those things you won't understand until you have kids yourself. A flash of white glinted in the corner of my eye. You had your phone out. The low, digital chirp pierced the silence as you tapped the screen. Dialing. I smacked the phone out of your hand. You yelped and stared at me, stunned.
What are you doing? We have to call 911!
There's nothing they can do for her. I picked up your phone. I told myself I only wanted to make sure I hadn't cracked the screen, not that I wanted to keep you from making that call. But still, your lips twisted the way they do when you're nervous or thinking.
They have to come get her. We have to tell them what happened.
No. It surprised me to hear the word come out of my mouth, but the decision was already made. Maybe it was made that day at Juilliard, or maybe it was made long before that. The day I canceled my appointment at the Boston Free Clinic and decided I would have this baby after all, and screw what my parents or anyone else thought. The day I first held you in my arms and realized I would do anything for you. Anything.
Mom?
You looked scared. Not just nervous, I realized, but actually scared. I let myself wonder if I wasn't making this entire situation worse. Maybe we should call the police. Call them and let the chips fall. Then I remember the Allemande from the box suite. How you had played it so beautifully, so flawlessly, the notes had dripped through my veins like blood. No. I steeled my resolve. I'm doing the right thing. We can't tell anyone, I explained to you as gently as I could. This is going to have to be our secret. Chapter 3. You stared at me. The word gobsmacked comes to mind now.
What are you talking about? Of course we have to tell someone. We can't just...
There's nothing anyone can do for her. I was trying to convince myself as much as you. They'll find her soon enough anyway, probably in a few hours. The joggers will be out. They were always out as soon as the sun came up, making the rest of us look bad. It wouldn't be long at all before someone in lycra shorts and lurid sneakers stumbled over Amber's body. But you shook your head.
They'll still know, Mom. Everyone knew Amber and I came here together.
Who's everyone? I asked, more sharply than I meant to.
Everyone?
A teenaged shrug.
Calvin and Ethan and Madison and Theo, a few others.
So not everyone, but your usual Oakwood crew. I could work with this. Where's Amber's phone? I asked.
In her pocket, I guess.
I looked down. Jacket or jeans?
Jeans, I think, in the butt.
Great. I crouched down. I hesitated for a second, but I turned off the part of my brain that was screaming in resistance. I rolled Amber onto her side. The rectangular outline of the girl's phone was clearly visible in her back pocket. I slipped it out and thumbed the screen. Any chance you know the passcode? I didn't dare hope, but you answered.
7847. It stands for P-U-G-S. Amber loves pugs.
You paused, eyes cast downward, but not at the body.
Loved.
Okay, good, Ella, good.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?